Hey guys, welcome to Telling the Told and Untold. My name is Zoro. Before we go straight into today's case, I do have to give you guys a couple of content warnings. In this video, we do talk about domestic abuse, sexual assault, and sex workers. So if that's not something you think you're interested in watching, then this video probably isn't for you. So maybe you can watch some of my other videos or just wait for my next upload. I should also note that on this channel, we don't shame sex workers for their line of work. So if you don't have anything nice to say, just don't say anything at all. And with that, let's go straight into it. First, I'm going to tell you guys about Carmen Nan Lee. She refers to herself as Nan, so for the rest of this video, I'll also be referring to her as Nan. And when she was a child, she attended a boarding school in Pietermaritzburg called Wycombe College for Girls, and she ended up not matriculating, finishing grade 12. And this was because she was a dancer and she had received an opportunity to be a dancer in Asia. So she set off to Hong Kong where she stayed, but things didn't go as planned and she ended up not being a dancer anymore. She soon got into sex work and she says that she was an escort. And it was during this time where she was an escort that she met a man and his name was Howard Greenspan. Howard was a businessman from Cape Town and he was living in Hong Kong at the time. And he was like a regular customer of Nan's and you could say they had like a long-term working relationship. And it was during this long-term working relationship of theirs that Nan fell pregnant in 1996. The two of them had an agreement though, and Howard wasn't going to be present in the child's life. He was going to be like a parental figure in terms of finances. So he was going to set up a trust fund for the child so that they would be able to go through school, but that was it. That was all he was going to do for this child, and I think Nan was okay with that. Then on the 15th of April 1997, Siam Lee was born. Nan seemed to be doing really well for herself, and her and Siam were still living in Hong Kong at this point, and things were just going really well. Nan described Siam's childhood for the first 5 years of her life as idyllic. They traveled a lot, and Siam also had a nanny who would look after her whilst Nan was at work. Siam attended a Montessori preschool in Hong Kong, and it was around the point where Siam had to start officially going to school, like she had to start primary school, and Nan thought it would be best if Siam attended primary school in South Africa. So this is when she decided to move back to South Africa with Siam, and they moved to KwaZulu-Natal and they lived in Durban. They moved back to Durban in 2002, and at this point Siam was 5 years old, and Nan was still doing pretty well for herself. She was renting out rooms to students, so like university students, so she was making a really good income, and her and Siam were really close, and you could tell that Siam took on a free-spirited nature just like her mother. The years would go by, and at this point Siam was 8 years old when tragedy struck. On the 4th of January 2005, her father, Howard Greenspan, was murdered. At the time, he was 52 years old, divorced, and living alone in a luxury apartment in Clifton, Cape Town, and he was found shot to death. It's said that a 28-year-old woman was found in the house and she was arrested. Some people speculate that she was a sex worker, but that has never been confirmed. And that's all we know. There hasn't been like any more information about his murder, why it happened, if someone was arrested and eventually sentenced. But that's really all we know about Howard's death. Howard's death really didn't affect Siam and Nan that much. All Nan wanted to do was make sure that Siam was paid her dues, and she did this by making sure that Siam's education was still going to be paid for, which it was. And because of this, Siam was able to attend some of the best schools in KZN. In 2011, when she was 14 years old, Nan wanted to move to Bloemfontein. And this was because, remember, like she was renting rooms to students. So that college had changed campuses. And because of this, she had lost a significant amount of her monthly income. So she wasn't making that much anymore. So she wanted to move to Bloemfontein and, you know, marry a farmer. summer, and she was going to send Siam to a boarding school in KZN. So she was looking around and she eventually found a boarding school that she was kind of happy with. So she went there and she told them like her plans, how she was going to move to Bloemfontein and Siam was going to stay there. And it was actually this school that convinced Nan to not do that, like to not send Siam to boarding school. And this was because they told Nan that boarding schools weren't the same as they were when she was in high school. And they said that on most weekends, students would go back home and like spend the weekend with their families. And it would be harder for Siam because she would be in the boarding houses all alone on weekends. Because obviously at this point, Nan would be living in Bloemfontein. So she'd be like in a different province altogether. And it wouldn't be easy for Nan to go see her mother on weekends. They also said that Nan was young and, you know, children just like being busy. So if she was in the boarding houses all alone on weekends without any friends, she would grow bored and maybe she would like sneak out and just do things that weren't really looked like, just do things that weren't good, you know. So they just didn't think that it would be in Siam's best interest that she go to boarding school. And Nan listened to them, and this is when she decided to enroll Siam at Crawford International College for her high school years. And Siam really liked the school. She made a lot of friends. She was happy, and it said that she was a really gifted child. It's not known when Siam found out about what her mother did for a living or how Nan told her, but during her high school years, she did find out that her mother was a sex worker, and it, like, she kind of knew not to tell her friends about it because they would like probably shame her mother, look down on them, and she just really didn't want that. And during her high school years, she also started becoming more and more like her mother, in the sense that she was a free spirit and she didn't abide by societal norms. And you could really tell that this was the kind of person that she was. You could see this through her social media posts and especially on her Instagram account, which still is up, and I'll link it in the description box. But in her Instagram bio, she describes herself as snot-nosed psychedelic elf, spending time in human form, spreading smiles like herpes, listen to your body, talk to plants, ignore people. So you could really tell that she was open. And some people have made some comments about like her Instagram posts. Some of them think that like maybe they're too sexual, even like her captions. But people just say that like she was just very open about herself, and she wasn't like provocative. She was just, you could say like she was like sexually liberated, you know, like she didn't care what people thought. She was a feminist, and I'm not saying there's anything wrong with being like provocative. That's what she wanted for your Instagram account or your account, you know. But she was just free and open, and she just really didn't care what people thought. Things seemed to be going really well for Siam and Nan. Siam's education was paid for. Nan was making a living still as a sex worker. But then during Siam's matric year, this is when things started changing. So both Nan and Siam were under the impression that Howard's Trust Fund would pay for all of Siam's education, primary, high school, tertiary education, but it seemed like that wasn't the case. So all these plans that Siam had to go to university, to become a teacher, and eventually move back to Hong Kong and teach there seemed to be put on hold because she didn't have any finances for university. So when Siam discovered that she didn't have any funding for her education, her plans had to change, and she started working and had various jobs to make money. She was a waitress, a bartender, she did some promotional work as well as some modeling. And Nan said that during this time, she watched Siam just begin to fade away. Like, she was just a shadow of the person that she used to be. And she was also pretty sad because she had all these plans and she wasn't able to, like her plans just changed without her wanting them to change. So she saw all of her friends get ready and go to university, and she wasn't able to do that. So that was just like so heartbreaking for her. And some people do say that she knows like it's not the end of the world that she wasn't able to go to university, but she had always planned to do this. And you know, like, I think it's, I think some people can relate. Like, it's not like she planned to take a gap year or like a couple of years off before going to university. Like, that was never her plan. So now when you see your friends going, doing things that you've always wanted to do, like, it hurts, you know? So 2016 ended and 2017 began, and Siam was still working odd jobs here and there, hoping that she could make her dreams of becoming a teacher come true. She was still living with Nan, and Nan was still a sex worker at this point, but something happened. So Nan got into an argument with one of her colleagues, and then this argument turned physical, and somehow during the whole altercation, boiling water was poured onto Nan and large parts of her body were burnt. So, you know, she had to go to the hospital and take care of those burns, and she had to stop working for a bit. But then those parts where she was burnt on became infected, and because of this, she had to stop working for longer than she had hoped for or expected. Like, it wasn't like she had to stop working for like 2 weeks or like 3 weeks, it was like a couple of months. And in her line of work, it's not like you get a monthly income, you know, like, you earn as you work. So if she's not working, she's not gonna make any money. So now they had to solely rely on Siam to pay for their lives, to pay for like the rent, food on the table, like everything. And this was really hard for Siam, but she, you know, she soldiered on. But what she was making wasn't enough to sustain them, and eventually they got evicted from their home. And this is when they just found themselves trying to find a new home, and this is when one of the people that owned the establishment that Nan worked at, she kind of said that they could come and live with them. And in the house that they lived in, it's kind of like a house for all the sex workers that worked at this establishment, and it was usually just for the workers, but they did allow Siam to also live there with them, and this was like their new life, their new reality. It's around this time when they moved into this establishment that one of the workers there asked Siam why she wasn't a sex worker. And this is when the wheels in Siam's head started turning and they wouldn't stop. So we don't really know if she had thought about becoming a sex worker before this worker asked her about it, or if it had been something that, you know, she had never thought about until that very moment. But she, like, you know, after they asked her this question, she started thinking about it and she really couldn't stop. And she was like, you know what? I think this is a good opportunity. Like, she could make a lot of money. So she asked Nan about it, and Nan says that she didn't want Siam to be a sex worker. She said no, but then Siam was very persistent and she eventually agreed. But Siam becoming a sex worker would come with T's and C's. And Nan said that Siam was not allowed to see any workers or like any clients without her being present. So the service Siam would provide was erotic massages, and Nan says that she never gave like the full sexual experience when she was a sex worker. So her work didn't include any penetrative things, it was just sexual or erotic massages. And there is evidence of this. So when news broke out of this case, there was a screenshot that was taken and uploaded of a website called redvelvet.com. And this is where the establishment, or like sex workers from the establishments, would advertise their services. So someone actually found Siam's profile. I'm not gonna put it up for you guys to see, but I will put a link to the picture so you guys can go look at it if you want, but I will describe the picture to you. So in this advert there are two pictures, and in both pictures you can see Siam and Nan. So in the first picture, Siam and Nan are lying on a blanket that's on the grass, and they're both lying down like on their backs and they're posing. Nan is in black lingerie and Siam is only wearing white underwear, and she's completely topless. And obviously, like, she's not wearing any pants or anything, she's just wearing her underwear. So she's lying on her back and her one leg is bent, and Nan is like lying on her side with her head in her arm, like on her arm, like on her elbow, like this, you know. And they're lying like next to each other, but they're facing opposite directions. So where Nan's feet are is where Siam's face is. And, you know, like that, like that's how they're posing. And then in the second picture, Siam is in the same position and her mom is standing. A lot of people find this picture very weird because, you know, like you're advertising your daughter's services as a sex worker and she's topless and you're in lingerie, you know? It's a bit weird. And then obviously as sex workers, they don't use their actual names. So Siam's name was student in training, and then under that it had a cell phone number, and then in brackets it says mention redvelvet.com. It has the area, which is Durban North, and then it says traveling, and next to traveling it says yes. And then it describes Siam as a stunning young college babe doing sensual massage. No FH available, no private numbers or SMS will be answered, available from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. So FH basically just means full house, which is slang for, you know, the full sexual experience, like penetration and everything. So no FH means no full house. So that kind of goes to what Nan said about Siam only doing erotic massages and not doing anything penetrative with her clients. And then on the side it also says that if you want like more pictures of the if you want more pictures of Siam, you can sign up to be a VIP, and then you can receive like exclusive pictures and selfies and just other things. So yeah, that's the advert of Siam online. It's not there anymore, but that was there. Nan says that Siam was doing sex work so that she would be able to save up enough money to go and study. But it was clear that by September 2017, Siam was not handling the job well on an emotional level. There was an advocacy organization that works with sex workers that said that Siam had reached out to them, and Siam had expressed to them that she was emotionally broken from the work that she was doing, and she didn't know how much longer she would be able to do it. And she had also reached out to this organization in the months that followed, and sometimes she donated her old clothes so that they could be given to other women who were struggling. In October 2017, a man named Xebelinkosi Gift Planning Thuli saw an advert advertised on redvelvet.com, and he booked a sensual massage with Siam Lee, and they met for the first time. He mostly refers to himself as Plani, and when you search this case, they only give you the names like Plani and Thuli. They don't say like his full name. So for the rest of this video, I'll also be referring to him as Plani and Thuli. Nan says that the first time that she met Plani, like nothing really stood out. Like she said that he was just friendly, he had a wide smile, you know, like he was just like all the other businessmen that booked them for like their services. So it was just like another man that just wanted a sex worker, you know, and she just didn't think much of it. So let me quickly tell you guys about Plani. At the time of the case, he was in his 20s and he was a well-educated and successful man, and he was a biochemist. He wanted to start his own business in regards to biofuels, and he had started saving money and also getting money towards this business venture of his. In 2014, he started a relationship with a former Miss South African teen runner-up, and her name is Lakeem Tembu. And when they first started dating, things seemed fine, but then she said that after a while he started becoming really controlling, and then they eventually moved in together. And once they moved in together, this is when the physical abuse started. She lived with him for about a year, and in this year he was physically, emotionally and financially abusive as well. And some point during their relationship they did get engaged. After a while, she realized that this was not what she wanted. She didn't want to be in this position, so she wanted to leave him, and she knew that like her trying to leave him would be dangerous, because you know, sometimes with men who are physically abusive, if you try to leave them, things can go one way or the other. So she took that leap of faith. She was going to leave him, and she told him this, and once she told him this, he physically assaulted her again, but she still managed to leave with her life intact. She later laid charges against him related to an assault that had taken place in his home in 2016, like when she had broken up with him, and then she would later lay further charges after that relating to his continuous stalking and harassment. And then after struggling for a bit, she finally managed to get a protection order against him. And after this protection order, he started going after her family, like, instead of her. Like, he started stalking her mother, and at some point, her mother's car had been set alight in the driveway outside of her house. And not too long after this, like, his mother was brutally murdered. And to this day, this case, that case has never been solved. Lucky has been very vocal about the fact that she believes that Pilani had something to do with both of these incidents. And after her mother was killed, there were still occasional instances of harassment from Pilani, but it seemed like he was happy with what he had done and what he had succeeded in terms of, you know, traumatizing Lucky. So he eventually left her. And then a couple of months would go by, and then in May 2016, like, he had felt like she had, you know, she had went through, like, her grieving process, and she was finally ready to fight back against Pilani. So she decided to press forward with her action against him. She says that the charges laid against him with the police were never followed up on, and each time that she would complain about him violating the protection order, no action was taken against him. And because of this, like, he then decided to take the bold step to be public about what had happened to her. So because of the platform that she had gained through her modeling and her business ventures, she had penned an 11-page statement to the then Minister of Police, Fikile Mbalula, and she released it publicly, and she detailed all the abuse that she had suffered at the hands of Pilani and Thuli. And then she also accused police of allowing a predator to walk the streets where he could easily harm other women. Because she had done this, there was a lot of press coverage surrounding this whole case.
He had beaten you to a point that he broke your ankle. I had to go into hiding for 4 years. If it's too good to be true, it probably is. I got 5 protection orders against him.
And after this, Pilani, like, not apologized to her publicly, but he basically just said that she was just lying to her and everything was not true. And then after this, he started terrorizing her again. This time it was, I don't want to say way worse than him allegedly killing her mother, but he started a website where he basically just posted revenge porn, just try and dehumanize her. And again, police did nothing. So that's everything we know about Pilani at this point. So now we're going back to his meeting with Siam. So after he met Siam for the first time, he was really interested in her and he wanted to see her again. So he decided to take her out on a dinner date. And a dinner date is one of the services that this establishment provided. And just depending on what kind of services you provide, after a dinner date, you can go on with, you know, your full house or whatever, but in Siam's case, it was just a dinner date and that's it. So on the night that they went for this dinner date, Pilani went to the establishment to go pick Siam up, and he arrived in his black Mercedes-Benz Viano. And after this, Nan went up to him and she introduced herself and she said, "Look, I'm student in training's mother and you must make sure that she's back home by 10 p.m. And then she let them go, and indeed Siam did come back home by 10 p.m. And the first thing she said when she walked through the doors is that she never wanted to see Pilani again. She described him as weird and creepy. And at the time, Nan just laughed it off because she didn't think that they would see, like, you know, they would ever see him again. But soon after the dinner date, Pilani continued to message Siam and request additional appointments with her. We don't know whether or not she still saw him after this dinner date, but, you know, he would still message her and try and see her. And this continued throughout November and December. On the 31st of December 2017, Siam and her mother attended a dance festival in Durban to go into the new year. And, you know, it was just a very happy time. There's even an Instagram post that Siam posted the following year about how she was sick, but she still managed to go into the new year. And between the 31st of December 2017 and the 4th of January 2018, it seemed as though Siam had grown tired of Pilani always sending her messages and trying to see her. So she just, you know, like she cut it off. Like she was done with him. She didn't want anything to do with him anymore. On that same day, the 4th of January 2018, at around 3 p.m., CCTV footage shows a black Mercedes-Benz Viano with Gauteng number plates pulling into the driveway of the home that Sam and her mom were living in Durban North, entering the premises. And it is believed one of two things happened. The first one is that Siam was outside of the house. She was barefoot in a summer dress. And then this black Mercedes pulled up. A guy got out of the car, showed her a gun, and then dragged her into the car and then drove off. The second thing is that this black Mercedes-Benz arrived at the house, like arrived on the premises. The guy got out of the car, went into the house, found Siam's room, and then dragged her out, put her into the car, and drove off. But what we do know is that on the 4th of January, Siam Lee was abducted. There are some reports that one of her colleagues saw her being abducted, and information after her abduction is a bit iffy. Like, it's like there are no like really confirmed reports about what exactly happened and how police came to find out about her disappearance. So whether after she was abducted, this coworker that saw her called police and they arrived on the scene, or if she was reported missing that day or the day afterwards. But she was eventually reported missing, and police didn't seem to care. Like, police weren't even trying. So because police weren't even trying to find Siam, her mom and other family members who lived in Australia had hired private investigators. They had hired two different private investigators. Nan had approached Moby Claw for help, and her family that had hired the other private investigators, it actually turned out that it was Siam's father's family who had hired this private investigator, and they had hired Brad Nathanson, and he would be a key player in this whole case. Brad is a private investigator in KZN, and he is pretty well known, and he's really good at his job, and he has worked on a number of high profile cases. So both Moby Claw and Brad Nathanson would go on to carry out their own investigations. And then on the 7th of January, Nan, accompanied by a friend, filmed a video for Moby Claw's Facebook page where she pleaded for Siam's safe return. And after this news report started coming out about Siam's disappearance, and a lot of people just focused more on what she did for a living. So when they would speak about a disappearance, it'd be like sex worker missing, you know, like just things like that. And they kind of reduced who she was to what she did for a living. This is when Durban North residents found out that one of the houses in the neighborhood was actually an establishment for sex workers. And then that was also like in the headlines because they couldn't believe it. Like, they thought, like, you know, this is just an area where, like, families and children, and they just didn't know that this was happening like in their backyards. Like, they just didn't know. And then they also discovered that Nan, so Siam's mother, was a sex worker, and this was terrible. It was just terrible for Siam's case, for Nan. They started blaming Nan for Siam's disappearance, and they said that she had basically groomed Siam to be a sex worker, and yeah, it was just a terrible time. By the 12th of January, so 8 days after Siam was last seen, police officers and private investigators were still looking for her. But what they didn't know is that on the 7th of January, a farmer and his grandson were working in cane fields in near Hanover in the Midlands, so about 100 kilometers from where Siam was last seen. They were walking through these cane fields when they came across a burnt body. They immediately called police. Police arrived on the scene, they took photos, and then this body was then taken to a mortuary so an autopsy could be done, as well as them try to identify who this person was. A few days after the body was discovered, in an extreme stroke of luck, or you could call it divine intervention, or just being at the right place at the right time, a photographer whose name is Jack Clausen, who works for Sunday Times, she was at the courthouse. So she had been tasked with taking pictures in one of the court cases, and it was during one of the breaks that she went out of the courtroom and she saw two police officers who were going to testify in another court case. So they were just outside the doors, just waiting to be called in, and she was just in there and she was just, you know, listening to their conversation. And this is when she heard something that shocked her. She heard that a burnt body had been found in New Hanover. And that wasn't like the surprising thing. What was surprising and kind of got her thinking was the fact that this burnt body had a lip piercing. And as soon as she heard this, she started thinking about the missing sex worker that she had heard about, and she knew that the sex worker also had a lip piercing. So she just continued on with her day, but she couldn't stop thinking about it. And then these police officers hadn't, like, they just like mentioned it, and then they continued on with their conversation. So once she was done with her day, she went back to the office. She immediately went to her boss and she told her boss what she had heard, and she was like, what are the chances that a burnt body has been found in the same province and it has a lip piercing, and that there's this missing 20-year-old or 21-year-old who has a lip piercing? Like, what are the chances of this? And they were kind of hoping that police had made that connection or had went through missing persons reports of like people who had lip piercings and then, you know, compare it and, you know, something. But police hadn't done that. Like, they hadn't made that connection, which is so frustrating because lip piercings are not that common, you know? Also, if someone goes missing, they literally tell you about like identifying marks, tattoos, piercings, you know, that's like one of the first things you look for. But no, they hadn't done this. But eventually they did. And once they kind of thought about the fact that this victim might be Siam Lee, this is when they decided to call in her family to let them know that they think they might have found her. The only problem is that they couldn't do a physical identification because the victim's body had been severely burnt and it was impossible to look at this face and identify the person. Also, the body also had blunt force trauma to the face, which had basically destroyed any facial features. So it was really impossible. But Nan said that she was able to do it. She was going to do it. So they said, okay, and they let her view the body. And she looked at this body and you could only see like pieces of hair, like string of hair. You could see the color of the hair. But then there was also one like hand that had been protected from the fire. So this hand was the only thing that was intact. So she looked at this hand and then she looked at the nail polish and she knew that nail polish color. That was Siam's favorite nail polish color. And as soon as she saw this, as well as the color of the hair, she was like, yep, that's my daughter, that's Siam. And police said, okay, and DNA evidence would later confirm that the body that had been found in New Hanover on the 7th of January was indeed Siam Lee. As all of this was happening, Brad had a lead. So he had received a phone call from a man who said that he had been driving in Durban North, about two streets away from the house where Siam had been abducted. He said that he was driving and then a black panel van Mercedes-Benz bumped into him after it passed a stop sign. And after this car bumped him, the car just continued driving, you know, like it didn't stop. And he was like, nope, you're not gonna get away with bumping my car and just leaving. So then he started chasing after this car. And then he bumped the back of this Mercedes so that he could stop the driver from driving away. But then the driver still didn't stop the car. And then the driver just drove off. So he thought that it was, you know, like he thought it might have something to do with Siam's case, because obviously they had CCTV footage of the black Mercedes-Benz Viano that drove into the house, like the yard. And it happened around the same time. It happened around 3 p.m. on the 4th of Jan. Brad said that after he received this tip, he used information from an insurance company to identify the address that the car had been registered to. And then when he pulled up the address on Google Maps, he realized that he had seen that house before in a different case that had happened just a year before Siam's case. So let me quickly tell you about that. So in 2016, a woman who is referred to as Kate had been abducted and sexually assaulted. She didn't want to open a case, she didn't want to report it, but she had told her parents about it. And there was one day where her parents were at church, and after Sunday's service, they went up to this private investigator whose name was Brad, and they told him what had happened to their daughter. So this is what happened to Kate. So Kate says that she had been abducted at gunpoint by a man who called himself Oscar. So Oscar had pushed her into the back of his Mercedes, and he told her to undress and lie between the seats. So you know that little gap between the front seat and the back seat. So he made her lie there naked, and then he started driving and drove all the way to his house. And then he opened the garage, drove in, closed the door, and then he opened the back seat and he pulled Kate out. He dragged Kate from the garage through the kitchen to a bedroom, and there he sexually assaulted her for a few hours. And the only reason why she managed to escape is because he let her go. And he let her go because she promised that she wouldn't report him to the police and she wouldn't tell anyone about what had happened to her. So once he released her, she went home and she eventually told her parents what had happened to her, but she was still adamant that she didn't want to open a case against this person. And the reason why her parents went to Brad, like, and approached Brad about this case was because they thought that if he was capable of abducting and sexually assaulting someone, then, you know, like, he's probably done it before, or maybe he will do it again. So they were just doing it for other victims. Kate couldn't tell Brad Oscar's surname, but she did say that she thinks she knows where the house is. She said that the house was on Controversy Drive in Addisey, Durban, and then Brad took Kate there and they drove up and down the street, and then Kate eventually pointed to one house and she said, I think that's the house that I was taken to. And they went to this house, but it turned out that it wasn't the right one. So now we're going back to Brad looking at this address on Google Maps. So when he saw that this house was on Controversy Drive, and he thought back to Kate's case and how Kate had been put into a Mercedes, and he thought about the black Mercedes and the fact that this house was on Controversy Drive too, he, you know, he just kind of put two and two together. And he was like, nope, I think these cases are related and it might be the same person who had kidnapped and sexually assaulted Kate. So the car wasn't registered to Planim Thuli, but the house that Brad had found was Planim's house. So they managed to identify him, and then on the morning of the 16th of January, Brad and his team went to Planim's house. They gained access and they opened the garage. Inside the garage, they found a black Mercedes-Benz Viano with Gauteng number plates, which had damage to the front and the back. Brad and his team then removed the car, and it's unclear when police arrived on the scene and their involvement in obtaining evidence and their arrest, but police had given Brad consent and were on the scene. Plani was not at his house when the car was seized, and after this, police said that they had other matters to attend to, so they told Brad that he should arrest Plani. So they said that he should just stay there and just watch the house, so when Plani finally arrived, or like he finally got home, then he should just make the arrest. So they just gave him like the go ahead. So police left, and then Brad got into his car and he parked a couple of like I think houses down and was just watching the house. And then after a few hours, Plani finally arrived home. So he drove up his driveway, and this is when he notices that his garage had like been broken into. So then he got out of his car, he went to the garage, he looked inside, and this is when he noticed that his car was gone. So we don't exactly know what he thought, like maybe he thought someone had broken in, like we don't know what he thought. But after he saw that his car was gone, he went back to his car and he was trying to leave, and this is when Brad and his team were surrounding him and they arrested him for the murder of Siam Lee. News broke that Plani Ntuli had been arrested, but at this point his identity was being kept a secret, and this was because Brad was trying to add Kate's rape and abduction charges to Plani's charge sheet. But you could also see like glimpses of him, like, you know, like maybe like side pictures and stuff. And this is when like he was like going through the news and she saw these glimpses of this person who had been arrested for the murder of Siam Lee, and she was like, I know that man. And she knew that it was Plani. So she called the police and she came forward with her experiences with him. And she was shocked that despite all of her efforts to get him off the streets, he was now accused of murder, you know? Then the charges that she had laid against Plani 3 years earlier were also going to be added to Plani's charge sheet. Plani was also interviewed by police, and Brad was present during this interview, and it's claimed that Plani did confess to some things, but it would later be clear that he was not going to plead guilty. Brad said that Plani admitted to abducting Siam, but he said that he had a reason. According to Plani, he said that after he had first met Siam, he had loaned her 50,000 rand. And then after this meeting, she started ignoring him, ignoring his call. She didn't want to pay the money back, and he got really upset and really angry. So he abducted her, took her to his house, he handcuffed her to the stair railing, and then there he sexually assaulted her for a few hours. And then she kept like threatening him. She kept saying that she was going to go to the police and they were going to arrest him. And because of this, this is when he decided that he had to kill her. So then he decided to strangle her, and then he said he tried strangling her, but then she just went through like seizure, like she started having seizure fits. And because he wanted to take her out of her misery, he then took like a piece of cloth, like I'm not too sure what it was, but like, or a blanket or something, and then put it over her head, and then he took a hammer and hit her several times. To put her out of her misery, he took a hammer and kept hitting her. He then loaded Siam into the back of his Mercedes, and then he drove to a nearby petrol station where he bought 25 liters of petrol, and then he drove all the way to New Hanover in the Midlands, and then he dumped Siam's body and set her body alight. All of this happened in 2 days. Siam was abducted on the 4th of January around 3 p.m. and he said that he dumped her body in the evening of the 6th of January. So everything that happened to her happened over a period of 48 hours, like 50 hours, you know? It's a long time. There were two pieces of evidence that they had against Plani. So the first one is that Plani didn't have a tracking device installed in his Mercedes for his own personal reasons. But what he didn't know is that Mercedes had installed a tracking device like when they made the car. So they had the data of all of his movements. So they looked up this data and they found that on the 6th of January, he was in New Hanover where Siam's body had been found. The second thing is the petrol station where he bought the petrol from. So the CCTV cameras weren't working at the time, but this was a petrol station that he would always go to. Like, you know, sometimes you have that like your favorite petrol station or petrol station that's close to home, and they know you, they know your car, you know, that kind of thing. So they knew who Pilani was, and they said that on the 6th of January he went to the petrol station and he bought 25 liters of petrol. So they had an eyewitness. On top of that, when Kate agreed to have her case added to Pilani's charge sheet, they immediately said that they wanted to have an identity parade to see if that to see if she could identify him. And almost immediately she pointed at Pilani and she said, yes, that's Oscar. After this, they also took her to Pilani's house on Conrad or Controversy Drive. It also turned out that the house that she had been in was actually next door to the one that she had identified with Brad a year earlier. So 2 years after she had been abducted and sexually assaulted, she walked through the house of Pilani Ntuli, who lived on Controversy Drive, and she identified it as the house that she had been brought to. So between January and February 2018, Pilani appeared in court on several occasions, and his charge sheet kept growing and growing. And each time they would mention a new charge, he would just look at them and he would just like shake his head like he was in disbelief and he couldn't believe it. Then 2 months after Siam Lee was brutally murdered, she was finally laid to rest. In that same month, Pilani started his bail application, and his team basically said that Brad had illegally arrested him, and all of the searches that they had done of Pilani's house were illegal and they hadn't been given a search warrant. Brad denied any wrongdoing and he said that everything he did was under the instruction of police. The state said that they didn't want Pilani to be out on bail because, number one, they thought that he would intimidate witnesses. The second thing is that they thought that he was a flight risk. And the third thing is that they said that they hadn't like done a thorough search of his house, and they believed that once they did the search of his house, they would be able to find like pieces of evidence that linked him to other victims, you know, like trophies that he had taken from his victims. And then the judge asked them how they hadn't searched the house in 4 months, because at this point it had been 4 months since they arrested him. They were like, you had 4 months to search his house, why haven't you searched his house in those 4 months? Which is a valid question, you know. During Pilani's bail application, Nan Lee had also been arrested, and she had been arrested because she had tried breaking into her home or an apartment where she stayed, and she was behind on rent, so her landlord wouldn't let her in, and this is when she decided to break in so she could try to get some of her things. She was arrested and she spent some time in jail just for a couple of days, and then she was released on bail. Despite the state's plea and the public outcry surrounding Pilani's bail application, he was eventually granted bail of 40,000 rand. 40,000 rand bail. And he has money, he can pay it. So he did pay it and he was released. And the reason why they said they agreed to like his bail application is because it turned out that some of the searches that they had done of his house were illegal, like they didn't have any search warrants. So some of the evidence that they had gathered could not be used. The second thing is that his team also said that Pilani was the sole provider of his family, and that he was also paying for one of his siblings' school fees, and this sibling was in private school. He was also apparently the person in charge of paying people's salaries. So after he had been arrested in January, a lot of people hadn't been paid. So their lives had been put on hold because he was in prison. So they said that it's not fair that other families should suffer because of him being in prison. So yeah, he was out on bail. By March 2019, so a year and 2 months after Siam Lee was brutally murdered, Pilani had still not been asked to enter a plea and he was still out on bail. Then on the 11th of March, he attended a court hearing and he was assaulted by a protester outside of the court and they threw a rock at him. When Pilani was first arrested, he seemed very healthy and nothing seemed wrong with him, but it did turn out that he was HIV positive, and from searches of the house, they didn't find any ARVs, so it didn't seem like he was taking ARVs. Maybe he was and they just couldn't find the pills, but that's what was happening. And I'm mentioning his status because it does come in later, so just take note of that. As the legal proceedings continued, Pilani started looking more and more sick. And on the 15th of May 2019, he appeared in court on crutches and he looked significantly thinner than he did before. At the hearing, a pre-trial date was set for July, but unfortunately, that day would never come because just over a month later, on the 21st of June, reports were made that Pilani Ntuli had died from skin cancer. The NPA asked that DNA or like fingerprints be taken to confirm that he actually died, and they also wanted a physical identification to confirm that it really was him. And after all of this was done, they came out to say that it is true and that Pilani Ntuli was in fact dead. Lakin Tembu said that she was relieved when she heard that Pilani had died, and she said this was because once he was released on bail, she was constantly looking over her shoulder, like she knew what he was capable of. So him being out on bail was really scary for her, and you know, she just feared for her life. And Nan Lee also said that at first she was relieved that he had died, but then she grew really angry because she felt like, you know, he had gotten away with murder. The public was not convinced that Pilani had died and they just found it really suspicious. And this is because it turned out that Pilani was actually a con man. He had apparently taken money from several people for a fake petrol business, and you know, he had made a lot of money from this, so they believed that, you know, it was possible that he had faked his own death. They also said that his death came at a very convenient time because he had died a week before his pre-trial date, so they were like, that's weird, that's suspicious. And then the third thing is that they couldn't believe that he had died from skin cancer, because a lot of people say that, you know, the chances of you dying from skin cancer are not, like, it's not impossible, but you know, it's not that likely. And that's just if you're in the States, maybe. But if you're in South Africa, it's quite possible. Also, because it is believed that he was HIV positive, if he had not been taking his ARVs, it is possible that he could have had skin cancer and died from it. But he didn't tell the court that he had skin cancer, and people thought that was suspicious too, because had he told the court that he had cancer during his bail application, it would have been likely that he would have been granted bail. Like, yes, he was still granted bail, but if he had said that he did have cancer, it was likely that, you know, it was gonna happen faster, and it would have been like a better reason, you know, for him being granted bail. And also it turned out that he hadn't told his legal team that he had cancer. Like, he told his lawyer that he was sick, but he didn't tell his lawyer what he was sick with. So people just thought that whole thing was weird. After the death of Siam and Pilani, Nan Lee moved to Bloemfontein, and she said that she was going to go to a rehabilitation center. No one knows why she wanted to go to rehab, whether it was for substance abuse or drug abuse, but either way, she said she was going to go to rehab. And then she said that she was also going to write a book about Siam and her childhood and her life. But after this, no one has really heard from her, and no one knows what she's doing with her life or where she is. Then in 2023, something seemingly unrelated happened and it came back to Siam's case. So news broke that Thabo Bester had faked his own death in prison and had escaped. And when people heard this, they started wondering if it was possible that Philani had done the same thing. They thought that maybe Philani had faked his own death and had evaded going to trial and possibly being sentenced to life in prison. And Brad, the private investigator, started getting so many phone calls and messages of people asking whether Philani had in fact died and if it's possible that he was still alive. And Brad said that to his knowledge, Philani is dead, but he can't say for sure because he never saw Philani's body. There were also some coincidences that people made with this whole case, and the first thing is that on the 4th of January 2005, Siam Lee's dad was murdered in his apartment in Cape Town, and then 13 years later, on the same exact date, the 4th of January, Siam Lee was abducted. The second thing is that in 2016, Siam had a photo shoot with one of her friends, and you can see these pictures on her Instagram account. And there's a picture of her lying in a cane field and she's lying on her back and she's just seemingly looking up into the sky, looking at nothing. And her caption says, "Don't mind me, I'm just waiting in a field to be abducted." It's so scary. Like, it's not scary, like, it literally just gave me goosebumps. Like, when I first read about that, I said goosebumps. So it's like, what are the odds? You know, what are the odds? Everything I've said about Plan Intuli in this video is alleged, and that's because he never got his day in court. What we can say, though, is that he conveniently died before standing trial, and his death has left so many people feeling as though he got off lightly after terrorizing and possibly murdering Lakin Tembu's mother, kidnapping and raping Kate, as well as kidnapping, raping and murdering 21-year-old Siam Lee.